Oscars are Sunday night, and while some of the contests have clear frontrunners, plenty still seem to be up in the air. 9 Best Picture contenders are scrapping for the top prize. Netflix is looking for its first big showing, and for the second year in a row, there's no host.
As always, we are ready to help you put together your watch list and prepare for your Oscar pool by giving you some of our own best guesses. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about the Oscars on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair is NPR film critic Bob Mondello. Welcome back, Bob.
Great to be here.
Always wonderful to have you. If you are new to our show and you want to catch up, we do have existing full episodes on all 9 of the Best Picture nominees. You can find those on Spotify. If you're a Spotify user, just search for Oscars 2020 from Pop Culture Happy Hour, and you can find them all in one place. So the 9 Best Picture nominees are Ford v. Ferrari. Ford v. Ferrari is Christian Bale and Matt Damon in the story of Ford trying to build a car to beat Ferrari in the Le Mans race. The Irishman is the Martin Scorsese film, which is on Netflix, that you might have heard. It's 3 hours long. Jojo Rabbit is Taika Waititi's story about World War II. That is the one with the where he plays an imaginary Hitler, if you've heard. Joker, of course, Joaquin Phoenix as the comic book character, sort of. Little Women, which is Little Women. You know Little Women, the Louisa May Alcott book adapted by Greta Gerwig. Marriage Story, which is Noah Baumbach's big divorce film with Adam Driver and also Scarlett Johansson. 1917, which is about 2 young men in World War I sent on a very dangerous mission directed by Sam Mendes. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio in Quentin Tarantino's story about the Hollywood of the very late 1960s, and Parasite, which is Bong Joon-ho's really fascinating story about 2 families who come together in a very unexpected way. Glenn, give me a quick will win, should win on Best Picture.
I'd be happiest with Parasite, a movie that just gets better and better the more you think about it. I'd be okay with Little Women or Once Upon a Time. Like, I like those movies. I'd be a little disappointed if it was Ford versus Ferrari for reasons you can hear more about in the full episode. And if it is The Joker, I'll scream into a pillow because I kind of hated that movie. The odds makers have 1917 winning, which is surprising to me because I like that movie, but the Best Picture of the year? Really?
It's Oscars-y, though,
yeah.
In the sense that it's a war movie and it's kind of a traditional Hollywood movie in some ways. But then at the same time, it has the kind of showy element of having the, you know, made to look like one shot. I will just go next and say I would pick Parasite. And, you know, I'm going to stick with will win Parasite because the last time I had a tingly feeling that it was going to be an upset, it was Moonlight. And I backed off at the last minute. And
So did the telecast.
And I,
that's
right. And I robbed myself of an opportunity to look smarter than I am. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say will win Parasite, should win Parasite. I'm okay with 1917. I think there is some lovely filmmaking there. I admire the accomplishment of it. Bob, what do you think will win and should win?
I think 1917 will win because just everything seems to be driving that way. It didn't start out that way. What's interesting is that the frontrunners initially were supposed to be Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and the 2 from Netflix.
Irishman.
Marriage Story.
And those have kind of disappeared from the conversation. I think it's safe to say none of those have a real strong shot anymore. Mm-hmm. I would love to see Parasite win.
Yeah. Stephen, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm in somewhat of the same boat. I would be thrilled if Parasite won. I would be thrilled if Little Women won. I love that movie so much. I went on record in our Resolutions and Predictions show. I predicted that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was going to win Best Picture. It seemed like everything was coming together for it. The Oscars love movies about the magic of movie making. Mm-hmm. It is a movie about old Hollywood. You know who else is old Hollywood? Everyone who votes for the Academy Awards. And so I felt so much like, and also Quentin Tarantino, he is an Oscars favorite, but he typically gets nudged over to screenplay and then doesn't win Best Picture or Best Director. So I really felt like he had an enormous amount of momentum going in, but I agree that 1917 seems to have kind of swooped in and picked it up. And I really like that movie a lot. I admire that movie a lot. I would be perfectly content and satisfied to have it win Best Picture. But this time next year, it will take me 30 to 45 seconds to remember what won Best Picture.
Unless it's Parasite.
Unless it's Parasite.
In which case, we'll all be talking about it for decades.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I wrote about this a little bit. If you subscribe to our newsletter, which is at npr.org/popculturenewsletter, I wrote about this last week, but I do think there's a chance it will be Parasite, partly because the opening up of the Best Picture category, which originally was talked about as a way to bring in kind of popular blockbusters that are also of quality, got a lot of talk about The Dark Knight and things like that. What it's actually done is bring in more smaller films and foreign language films. So eventually it's going to happen that one of them is going to win.
It might as well be this one.
I think it might be this year. I think people just like that movie.
Yeah, and the fact that they use preferential voting for this particular category, it's way too complicated to get into here. Mm-hmm. But basically what it means is if people liked Parasite, for example, enough to put it number one, number two, or number three, it's got a better than average chance. Your second choices have a better than average chance.
Less polarizing films sometimes do better than that. You know, ones that everybody kind of likes, even if it's not their favorite.
Right.
All right. So let's move on and talk about some acting categories. Lead actor, you have Antonio Banderas in Pain and Glory, Leonardo DiCaprio in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Adam Driver in Marriage Story, Joaquin Phoenix in Joker, and Jonathan Pryce in The Two Popes.
Two Pope Mania!
Glenn, who's your best actor pick?
Well, it's going to be Joaquin Phoenix. I've made my peace with that, but I just urge people to check out Antonio Banderas in the Spanish film Pain and Glory. It's the Pedro Almodóvar film where he's playing a version of Almodóvar himself. He plays this aging filmmaker looking back on his life with regret. It's just a terrific movie, and he gives such a layered, soulful, and very kind of melancholy performance. It's great. But yeah, it's going to be Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah. Bob, what do you think?
I agree, and on both points, really, that Antonio Banderas is doing the best work he's done in decades since he started as a Hollywood actor, and that it's an extraordinary performance. It's a beautiful movie. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think, Stephen?
Jonathan Pryce looks exactly like Pope Francis.
Sure.
And so
sure.
And I talk a lot about original versus adapted performances. Mm-hmm. If you are playing a real-life person, it is a completely different skill set than if you are inventing a character. I do think Jonathan Pryce does a fantastic job imitating a real person. Mm-hmm. I agree that
imitating a real person. I like that. That's a notion.
We'll get to the bombshell in a second. I agree that Banderas is terrific in Pain and Glory. I agree that Joaquin Phoenix, I think, is going to win. I do want to put in a word for Adam Driver's performance in Marriage Story. I really loved that film. It's on Netflix. If you have Netflix and you haven't seen it, I think it's beautiful. And I think his work in it is tremendous. So I would be delighted if Adam Driver ended up winning. I don't think he will.
Yeah, I think it's pretty. I'm like Glenn. I'm resigned to it being Joaquin Phoenix. I don't even think this is Joaquin Phoenix's best acting.
No, absolutely.
Exactly. I want to make it clear that I have a huge amount of respect for him. This isn't my favorite thing for anybody to do, but it is the thing that is most likely to win awards because it's very big and very loud, and the acting kind of draws a lot of attention to itself. It also features the kind of physical transformation of becoming very, very thin, and it's a kind of traditional idea of what wins awards. But I would also probably pick Banderas. There's a scene where the character has a conversation with a man that he was involved with long ago. And that scene is so gentle and surprising. And it's all about, I mean, not to take anything away from the writing, but it is all about those performances. And it has such nuance. And I loved that performance. And I think I loved this. I loved this film. Let's move on to Best Actress. You've got Cynthia Erivo in Harriet, Scarlett Johansson in Marriage Story, Saoirse Ronan in Little Women, Charlize Theron in Bombshell, and Renee Zellweger in Judy. I'm going to mix it up and go over to Stephen first. What's your pick in Best Actress?
Well, I mean, I would love to see Saoirse Ronan win. I think she's so terrific basically in everything she's done, and she's fantastic in Little Women. It's pretty clear, kind of wire to wire, that this is Renee Zellweger's award to lose. And as much as I rail constantly about imitation as acting being a thing that frustrates me, how they, you know, they give Oscars kind of for these prosthetic-laden imitations. You know, you have Charlize Theron in Bombshell imitating Megyn Kelly in a performance that really, we talked about how soulful Antonio Banderas' performance, that is is how not soulful I felt this Charlize Theron performance was. I actually, I'm going to steer against my tendencies and say I loved Renee Zellweger in Judy. I, as much as that is an acting performance that is an imitation of a real life person, I think she imbues that performance with real soul and real pain and real emotion that transcends an imitation of a famous person. I thought that was a terrific performance, and I liked that movie more than I expected to. I hadn't, you know, it hadn't really gotten any awards buzz outside of that Renee Zellweger performance, but it really worked for me.
Yeah, I agree with you, Stephen, because I think, although I share your skepticism about imitations, I didn't necessarily look at Renee Zellweger and think she looks so eerily like Judy Garland. Mm-hmm. And yet, she has a Judy Garland-ness to her in this performance that seems very evocative to me of Judy Garland without being visually evocative particularly. They've obviously got the makeup and the hair that she was sporting at this time in her life, but I did find something about her, even though it's not the voice and it's not the look exactly. It's some other recognizable to me Judy Garlandness.
There's another thing going on in that movie that is that movie is her, right? The reason that she was nominated for it is that it is so centrally her.
Right.
It's doing the right stuff, but she is giving one of those sort of masterclasses in acting.
Well, Bob, you and I are gay men of a certain age. We've seen a lot of people imitating Judy Garland over the years.
This is true. And, this is true. Most of them men.
And yes, exactly. And so what she's doing, she's not imitating, she's evoking. And that's a high wire act to do. That said, as much as I like that performance, Saoirse Ronan in Little Women just infuses that film with passion, with emotion, with an urgency that in a period drama you kind of want. You kind of need something to kind of connect to the audience in a really basic, understandable way, and she did that. So I would love to see it, but it's going to be Renee.
Yeah, I agree.
We've never talked about Harriet on this show. I love Cynthia Erivo. This movie, this performance, even this performance, which is so good, still left me really cold.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to go to supporting actor. You've got your Tom Hanks in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood playing Fred Rogers, Anthony Hopkins, the other Pope in The Two Popes.
Catch the Wave.
Al Pacino and Joe Pesci both in The Irishman, playing sort of the Al Pacino and Joe Pesci roles in The Irishman, and Brad Pitt in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, I'm going to say Brad Pitt will win. Mm-hmm. Brad Pitt has been winning all of the, you know, pretty much all of the precursor awards. And I think I would go with Brad Pitt. I think Brad Pitt is the thing about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that I liked. I was not on the show where you covered it. My basic reaction to it was great directing, disappointing script, really nice performance from Brad Pitt.
But that's the Brad Pitt role, though. If any other actor was playing that part, you'd think, why didn't they get Brad Pitt for this? This is Brad Pitt's role. I actually think he went outside of his comfort zone. He had more to offer, more to do this year in Ad Astra, which kind of wasn't exactly the kind of straight down the middle Brad Pitt role. I, in the year 2020, am pulling for Joe Pesci of all people because I don't think it's a typical Joe Pesci performance. In fact, I don't think he brings any of that kind of manic, squirrely It's a very still, centered performance of a kind that I have not seen from him before.
You're absolutely right. I felt that being unfair, as I was saying. I was
teeing up to make the exact same point if you'd gone to me first.
I will say this. It's a Joe Pesci kind of movie, but the Joe Pesci part in that movie. And I agree, and I retract. Stephen, what else do you think besides that I had that wrong?
Well, I mean, speaking to the Joe Pesci performance, which I also really loved, is I loved it kind of equally as much as I did not respond well to the Al Pacino performance, which was Al Pacino ramped up over the top. The Joe Pesci performance was so much more contained and quiet, and I think worked really beautifully. I agree. I'm pulling for Pesci a little bit, even though Pitt will absolutely win. I also love Tom Hanks. Not going to win.
Sure.
I don't like any of them. I honestly don't. This is the category that infuriated me when it was nominated. It's all big deal actors. Mm-hmm. They are pushing out of the category all of the interesting actors this year who had supporting roles. I mean, if I were giving it to somebody, I'd probably give it to Tracy Letts for Ford v. Ferrari, as that scene that all by itself says, I just stole the movie, right? Yeah, sure, it's going to go to Brad Pitt, but I think this is one of those times where the Academy is nominating the wrong people. That, you know, you put Tom Hanks up for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood because you don't want him running against best actors.
Yeah.
Right? Not because he isn't a central performer in that
yeah.
movie.
Yeah.
So anyway.
No, fair point. Fair point. And I think the big takeaway from that category is my apologies to Joe Pesci. So we've got supporting actress Kathy Bates in Richard Jewell and Laura Dern in Marriage Story, Scarlett Johansson in Jojo Rabbit, Florence Pugh in Little Women, redeeming Amy March, and Margot Robbie in Bombshell. What do you think, Bob?
Well, Kathy Bates is remarkable in Richard Jewell. She's playing Richard Jewell's mom.
Yeah.
Fiercely protective woman. And you get that in the opening scene. What you don't get is the layers of her devotion to her son,
right.
who is not the quickest guy around and who she has spent her whole life being there for. And when you finally see, she's got a scene that is the Oscar-winning scene. And when you get there, you think, oh, yeah, she can deliver.
Interesting, interesting. What do you think, Glenn?
It's going to be Laura Dern. She's been kind of soaking up all the awards. And far be it for me to reign on the Dernissance, but Florence Pugh in Little Women, I mean, she single-handedly, as you mentioned, Linda, she rehabbed a universally hated character with one simple thing. She imbued that character with a very clear-eyed intelligence, which is not something you would necessarily associate that character with. And just every line sounded completely naturalistic in a film that could have sounded kind of stilted. So I really love that performance, and I hope she gets it, but it's going to be Laura Dern.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it will be Laura Dern. I also probably would pick Florence Pugh.
Yeah, I agree completely with Glenn. I think Florence Pugh is not only fantastic in Little Women. I would love to see her win. I agree that Laura Dern will win. But I also think, you know, you're not necessarily supposed to take into consideration other performances that an actor gives in a given year, but Florence Pugh is also the star of Midsommar and is phenomenal in that movie. It does so much acting with her face. I felt like this was Florence Pugh's year in so many ways. I would love to see the Academy acknowledge that, though I agree it's likely to go to Laura Dern.
Someone said to me afterwards that Florence Pugh was the woman who I had reviewed so favorably in Lady Macbeth, and I honestly didn't recognize her.
Yeah.
It was like, whoa.
Well, and she's coming up in Black Widow.
Yeah, she is.
In the Black Widow movie as well. So she's going to have, I think, some more opportunities for prominence.
And I do think Margot Robbie is really good in Bombshell. If you were going to acknowledge a performance in Bombshell, it is kind of the one that is not just imitating a famous person.
Yeah.
And I think she brings a lot more to that character than she might have otherwise.
She's got a couple of, I think, really difficult and complicated scenes that I think she plays very well.
Right, and we should note Scarlett Johansson nominated for both lead and supporting this year. That doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
Both those performances are good. Others were better.
Yeah. And before we get off the acting categories, I do just want to mention very quickly that with all the nominations that Parasite won, they didn't nominate any of its cast, which I think is something of a scandal.
Mm-hmm.
I would particularly mention Park So-dam and Song Kang-ho playing the daughter and the father in the family that is at the center of the film. So
especially after they won the SAG
Ensemble.
If they're the best actors of the year, how could they not get nominated for anything?
I think that's a scandal stretching across all these categories that I did want to mention. All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about more Oscar nominees, including Best Director, Animated Feature, Best Song, and much more. So stick around.
Women in America have long vied for the highest political office, the presidency. This week on Throughline, how things have changed, and not, for female presidential candidates throughout American history. Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time to understand the present.
Welcome back. Let's dive right back in. Nominated for Best Director, Martin Scorsese for The Irishman, Todd Phillips for Joker, Sam Mendes for 1917, Quentin Tarantino for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Bong Joon-ho for Parasite. Bob, who do you think takes it?
Wow. I'm not sure. This is the category that I think is the most out there. I'd love to see it be Bong Joon-ho.
Mm-hmm.
I think arguably, it's the most beautifully directed film of the year.
I agree with Bob that I'd love to see it be Bong Joon-ho, which is visually, everything about that movie is so beautifully directed. I think Mendes is going to win for 1917,
right,
in part because of the technical feat involved. The one I really want to win is Greta Gerwig, not nominated.
Yeah, exactly.
And if it's Todd Phillips or Joker, I will take to the streets and start turning over cars.
Yeah, if you follow my theory that Parasite is going to win Best Picture, then Sam Mendes will win Best Director.
Yes, yes.
But those are things are all dependent on each other, so it gets very complicated. I've got a whole board with tacks and yarn. Cinematography, Rodrigo Prieto for The Irishman, Lawrence Sher for Joker, Yaron Blaschke for The Lighthouse, Roger Deakins for 1917, and Robert Richardson for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think everybody thinks it's going to be Roger Deakins, right?
Yeah, it's going to be Roger Deakins.
It's going to be.
But just as for Yaron Blaschke, work on The Lighthouse, I'm going to stand for The Lighthouse again. Look, this thing was filmed in a different aspect ratio. It's this gorgeous textured black and white photography, which means he had to flood the set with so much light that in certain scenes the actors couldn't see each other. But the result is so gorgeous and so wonderful. But yeah, it's going to be Deakins, of course. It's going to be Deakins.
We always love talking about screenplays with Glenn in particular. Glenn loves talking about screenplays. Adapted screenplay this year, The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, Joker, Little Women, and The Two Popes. Glenn, what do you think takes this one?
Well, if there's any logic, and there isn't, but if there was any logic, it's Greta Gerwig, because she took the source material and restructured it to make it seem fresh and alive.
Yeah.
However, Taika Waititi took the novel that Jojo Rabbit is based on and also did a lot with it. He inserted that imaginary Hitler character, which wasn't in the novel, and he has been soaking it up. He's been winning all of them, so it's probably going to go to Waititi, but man, what Greta Gerwig did was so fascinating.
Yeah, and I should mention it's Steve Zaillian for The Irishman and Anthony McCarten for The Two Popes, and of course, Todd Phillips and Scott Silver for Joker, another one that I'm sure Glenn would love to see run away with it. Original screenplay, Knives Out by Rian Johnson, Marriage Story by Noah Baumbach, 1917 by Sam Mendes and Christy Wilson-Cairns, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood by Quentin Tarantino, of course, and Parasite by Bong Joon-ho and Han Jin-won. Now, I'm going to say, I think Parasite will win and should win. Mm. But I also want to say a part of my heart belongs to Knives Out.
Yes.
And I will not be sad if, as long as Parasite wins a bunch of other things, I would love to see Knives Out take this because I think it is so impeccably written. And
it
I think
really
it's the
is.
Kind of movie where it's easy to miss how impeccably written it
right.
is. And I loved that movie. Oh, I love that movie.
I'd be happy with any winner here, but I don't think anybody's going to tell you that the thing that makes 1917 as good
right.
as it is the script. That's the thing that mystifies me about
yeah.
the nomination.
Yeah.
I actually think this one could go to Quentin Tarantino because
yeah.
they're not going to give him
yeah.
Best Director.
I agree, too. I think that the default is Tarantino ends up taking mm-hmm. this one. But, man, I also think that Baumbach script for Marriage Story is really beautifully done.
Yeah, I think it's one of those where it's a really stacked category. I think
yeah.
in another year, Baumbach would have a great chance
yeah.
for Marriage Story. But I think there's so much going on in this category. So in animated feature, they've got five nominees. We're going to go through them and give you our best intel. Steven, tell me about How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World.
How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World is the conclusion of this story that's been unfolding over these very artfully made How to Train Your Dragon movies, which there is an audience for those that loves those movies very, very dearly. They are very, very well made, but they are very 2.5 to 3 stars if you're me.
Mm-hmm.
They're very nicely made. If my kids were the appropriate age, I would never dread going to see them. But for me, you know what I like better than How to Train Your Dragon Hidden World? Frozen 2. I think Frozen 2 is so underrated, including by this panel. I think that movie is terrific, and it should have been nominated. Justice for the poor Disney Corporation
yeah.
sold short again.
Oh, all right. Bob, tell me about I Lost My Body.
I was so looking forward to talking about Frozen 2. I Lost My Body is an extraordinary French film about a hand which is sitting in a lab and gets up and walks away on its fingers and starts climbing around and it's searching for its body. And you don't know for a while why they keep talking about these other characters who are out there. And then it becomes clear why they're doing it. What is really interesting about the animation is, and this is one of those films that you watch the first couple of minutes as this hand is climbing out of the lab, and I thought there is more interesting work being done in this than in any other animated film I've seen this year in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's breathtaking. And when the hand is sitting up on a roof ledge or something like that, and two of the fingers go down from the ledge, and you realize how much it looks like legs.
Right, sure.
It's just, it's beautiful.
It is so strange and so dark and kind of brutal in places.
Yeah.
And
so this is
mysterious.
Animated. Is this an animated feature for adults?
Yeah, this is what I would say. It's
okay.
An adult film because some of the symbolism, some of the themes are really about like stalking and like it's
right.
It's got this whole very layered, very
and
rich
fate
and destiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in addition to everything else, it's available on Netflix.
So I want to go from that kind of darker film to Klaus, mm-hmm. which is also on Netflix.
Right. And I put off watching it for a long time because it is the Santa Claus origin story. And we've seen lots and lots and lots of those kind of things before, and they're all kind of treacly and awful. This is a lot of fun. First of all, it's designed so well. It is so well executed. It is just every line is doing characterizing work on every face, on every feature. And it just looks fantastic. It owes a lot to Tim Burton in terms of the kind of the stylized nature of it, but it doesn't feel like it's an imitation of Tim Burton at all. And it does owe a lot in tone to The Emperor's New Groove.
There's a
main character who's kind of like a kind of slacker dude.
Jason Schwartzman as David Spade.
Totally. But he brings a lot to it. And it is, again, solid, solid jokes, really strong performances. But yes, The Emperor's New Groove walked so that Klaus can run, but you should check it out. It's a lot better than I thought it was going
to
be.
Okay, Klaus. And now we're going to go to one that I suspect Steven did not like as much as Frozen 2, which is Missing Link.
I did think Missing Link is very, very cute. It is a very big budget Leica movie. Mm-hmm. It is about...
stop motion, right?
Stop motion, and it is about an explorer and a Sasquatch played by Zach Galifianakis. It is stop motion animation by Leica. It is a very, very big budget movie that cost a ton and made very, very little. It ended up actually winning Best Animated Feature at the Golden Globes, in part because it is an incredibly extravagant epic from a kind of production design standpoint.
Exactly.
They built these incredibly elaborate sets for it, just spared no expense on everything except the humans' faces, which are so ugly.
Yeah.
but it is a sweet. I found the story actually a little slight.
Yeah.
I thought the Galifianakis performance is very warm and lovely, but it is the kind of movie where you walk away like, oh, that was pretty good.
And then the last in that category is Toy Story 4, which we have talked about on this show, Forky Forever and Friends.
Justice for Forky.
Steven, what do you think should and will win?
I think Toy Story 4 will win. And you know what? I really loved a couple of these movies. I agree with you, Glenn. I think Klaus is terrific, but I'm absolutely fine with Toy Story 4 winning. I think it wasn't necessarily a necessary addition to the franchise, but I think it's delightfully done.
How about you, Glenn? Should and will win?
Toy Story 4 is going to walk away with this, but apart from Forky, I don't really remember much about that movie.
Yeah.
I Lost My Body is weird, but Klaus is a lot of fun.
All right. Awesome. How about you, Bob?
I think I would go with I Lost My Body. I liked it the best, but I doubt that it'll win.
Okay, let's go on to Best Documentary Feature. We're going to start with The Edge of Democracy, which you saw, Stephen.
Yeah, Edge of Democracy is about kind of the unfolding scandals with the president of Brazil. Anyone who's followed that story of Dilma Rousseff, who was removed from the presidency, and also Lula, former president of Brazil, who was imprisoned. This kind of follows their story as it unfolds. And what jumps out about the movie is just the amount of access it has.
That's exactly what I was
you
say.
Are seeing behind the scenes of these politicians as people, and kind of, you know, from the filmmaker's point of view, this unfolding tragedy of politics there and how a country slides into authoritarianism. It is bleak. The cumulative effect of it, it is a kind of punishingly sad movie. I don't know that it's made with an enormous amount of flair beyond the amount of access that it has. I did ultimately find it fascinating.
Yeah, and The Edge of a Democracy is available on Netflix. So is the second one in this category, American Factory. One thing you may have heard about American Factory is that the Obamas were producers on it. This is the story of an Ohio GM plant that closed down and then was taken over by a Chinese company that makes glass. And so they kind of use some of the same workers and bring in more people, and some people come over from China. At the beginning, you get kind of a culture clash of these, you know, the people who have worked in this plant forever and the people coming in. What I really appreciated about it was that it becomes about manufacturing losses and job losses and economic struggles without equating Rust Belt factory workers with white people. It has a more diverse look at who is working in this factory and who is affected by this factory shutdown. So I really did like that film. Glenn, you saw the next one. We're going to talk about The Cave.
Yeah. And, you know, bleak is kind of a nice running theme for these documentary features, as it usually is. It's glib and fatuous to say that a film that is chronicling a great evil, a great urgent humanitarian crisis, is a tough sit. That said, this film is a tough sit, and it wants to be. It's not trying to make you stay complacent. It wants you to act.
What's it about?
It's about an intricate system of tunnels and shelters on the outskirts of Damascus that form a massive underground hospital. The film takes place during the siege. We follow the staff, including the pediatrician Amani Balor. They're saving lives while the city is being bombed and attacked with chemical weapons. She also has to deal with a lot of everyday BS from her male colleagues, who are just incredibly sexist. It's inspiring in that she stays and she does what she can, but it's a great, urgent need where thousands and thousands of people are dying and died. So, yes, yeah. That's what The Cave is about.
And so that is about Syria. Mm-hmm. Stephen, you saw another one that is about Syria called Farsama.
Yeah, well, if you want to make a snappy double feature about about war in Syria, Farsama, streaming at pbs.org. They make it very easy to watch. That is the only way in which it is easy to watch. This, as you said about The Cave, you know, this is following the experience of doctors attempting to save lives in a city that is being absolutely bombarded and pummeled. The Cave, you kind of describe a little bit of the claustrophobia. It's, you know, if it's set in these underground tunnels. Farsama kind of tries to kind of crane its neck out of the rubble a little bit. You have a lot of overhead shots, as well as a lot of footage that's shot on iPhone cameras. Like I said about The Edge of Democracy, part of what stands out is just the sheer amount of access to the ground level horrors of this terrible, terrible, terrible conflict in which these people are just caught in the middle of just relentless barrages of gunfire. And what you take away from Farsama, unfortunately, it's the images of dead children. And there are a lot of images of dead children. It is a very painful movie to watch. It is an important movie to watch. You will not have fun. It's hard to say. I highly recommend it because it's horrible to watch, but it is also important.
All right. And I think, Bob, that Honeyland is the one of these that is maybe the least bleak in description.
No, absolutely. And I heartily recommend it. It's an extraordinary film about a woman in Macedonia who is keeping bees in the way that people probably kept bees for the last 1,000 years. And she lives next door to a guy who starts to keep bees in the way of sort of an industrial manner, mm-hmm. right? In beehives that are he arranges on his property. And the conflict between the two of them. When I first heard about this movie, I thought, okay, why do I want to see this? It's about beekeepers. How interesting can that be? And in fact, it becomes really compelling, and she becomes such a character. And this film, Honeyland, was actually nominated not just for Best Documentary, but also for Best Foreign Language Film, uh-huh. which says something about the level at which it's working, which is a very affirmative and humane level to talk about societies and how they're changing in ways that aren't necessarily good, but that the adaptive quality of this woman is extraordinary as you're watching it.
And Honeyland is available on Hulu.
Right.
And I think out of those, it seems like American Factory is pretty heavily favored. Mm-hmm. But I think we all got something out of watching all of them. And Honeyland, as Bob mentioned, was nominated not just for Best Documentary, but also for Best International Feature Film, which used to be Foreign Language Film. They've changed the name of the category, but not the rules. Also nominated in that category are two films we've already talked about, Parasite and Pain and Glory. But we do want to talk about the other two in that category, in addition to Honeyland. Corpus Christi is from Poland. Glenn, you saw that one.
Yeah, it's about a young man who gets paroled from juvenile detention and finds himself in a remote Polish village and proceeds to pretend to be a priest. Turns out he's pretty good at it. This is a solid little film driven by a really compelling performance by the lead actor, mm-hmm. Bartosz Bielenia. He's got this wide, watery stare that makes you just want to confess to him. Yeah. So, pretty good.
And Bob, you also saw Les Miserables, which is not the musical.
I was going to say the music is fantastic.
France.
It's like, oh my God. It is a story set in contemporary, on the outskirts of Paris, in the same neighborhood as Victor Hugo that he was writing about and also that he actually composed the novel in. And it is about contemporary, mostly African emigres who are sort of not assimilating into the rest of Paris, particularly because the Parisians are keeping them back. And it's I think a really powerful film. I was surprised at how moving I found it. And you see a lot of societal fracturing going on in the space of very short times. It's very much about the things that Victor Hugo was writing about.
Right.
You know, wow.
You're introduced to all these disparate groups, and then as the story moves forward, they all kind of cohere, and the tension just keeps rising and rising. And
when they start singing, it's amazing.
They don't start singing. It does feel a little didactic sometimes, a little schematic, but yeah.
I think everybody expects Parasite to win in this category, but are there any particular favorites that you'd love to see, that any of you would love to see kind of pull it out?
Pain and Glory.
Pain and Glory.
Loved Pain and Glory. So, Stephen, we always look to you to give us a little bit of intel on original song and score. So in original song, you've got I Can't Let You Throw Yourself Away from Toy Story 4. I'm Gonna Love Me Again from Rocket Man. I'm Standing With You from Breakthrough. Into the Unknown from Frozen 2. And Stand Up from Harriet. Stephen, give me whatever intel you have.
Well, it seems like the actual award is going to be between Into the Unknown from Frozen 2, one of those big Disney I want anthems. Your kid, if you have one, is probably singing it right now. And I'm Gonna Love Me Again from Rocket Man, which is a really solid kind of middle-of-the-road Elton John banger. Either one of those would win, and I wouldn't be surprised. As for the other songs, I Can't Let You Throw Yourself Away is kind of a cute Randy Newman Toy Story song. It happens to at least not just be like, you're my friend. So I appreciate that, but it feels like an also-ran see also. I'm Standing With You from Breakthrough, which is Diane Warren's 11th Oscar nomination. I think she's writing songs using an app. at this point, that song is so generic and turgid. And Stand Up from Harriet. Actually, that is the title of the song, Stand Up from Harriet. It actually, people don't realize this, it is from the movie Harriet featuring the song Stand Up.
All right.
But that is actually a song co-written by Cynthia Erivo, who sings it. But it is, in my mind, it could have been written by Diane Warren's app.
Yeah, all right. So what can you tell me about score, Stephen?
Well, the score nominees are Hildur Gunnadottir for Joker, Alexandra Desplat for Little Women, Randy Newman for Marriage Story, Thomas Newman, no relation, for 1917, and John Williams for Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker.
Indeed.
In terms of what is likeliest to win, that 1917 score is a big and majestic, blustery, and beautiful thing at the same time as it also has some of the notes of kind of like Arrival, a little bit more haunting. I think that's a beautiful score. I love Alexandra Desplat's Little Women score. That's one I sometimes listen to independently of the movie, but it does feel like Hildur Gunnadottir, who did the score for Joker, that seems like, other than Joaquin Phoenix, the Oscar that Joker is likeliest to win.
Thank you, Stephen, for that helpful intel. That brings us to the end of this wild wrap-up of so many categories. Tell us what you think about this year's Oscar nominees. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what's making us happy this week, so come right back. Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Legendary Children, the first decade of RuPaul's Drag Race and the last century of queer life is a book that's going to come out on March 3rd. It's by Tom and Lorenzo of the fashion and culture blog Tom and Lorenzo, and it's exactly what it says it is. It is a look at recent queer history through the lens of RuPaul's Drag Race. Now, if that sounds awfully limiting at first, it did to me. The more you read it, the more you understand that it's a useful focus for a topic that's as broad as queer history. Useful because RuPaul and Drag Race itself are basically just pastiche as organizing principle. They're constantly name-checking and paying homage to various aspects of what's gone before. And you learn things. I learned, for example, that very famous photo of a hippie in the Vietnam era putting flowers into the gun barrels of Metropolitan Police, that guy became a very famous drag queen named Hibiscus, who formed the Coquettes, a kind of underground theater troupe in San Francisco, whose membership included both Divine and Sylvester of You Make Me Feel Mighty Real. So that's Legendary Children, the first decade of RuPaul's Drag Race and the last century of queer life, coming out March 3rd.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. All right, Bob, what is making you happy this week?
I just saw a new movie. What's making me happy this week is that I got a new puppy, but I'm not allowed to talk about that because nobody can share that puppy. Nobody's the next 2 years.
Nobody is allowed to talk about dogs on this podcast.
I've heard that. So in any event, I went to see a movie called Emma. And Emma is, of course, the basis for Clueless. And there was a version of Emma that came out back then and that I didn't think much about back then.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Right. And this time, I'm watching this movie of Emma, which is made by Autumn de Wilde, who is a...
Great photographer.
Yeah, she's a wonderful photographer. And she made something called Six by Sondheim a little while ago. And I saw that. And that was why I went to see it. I'm the least literary person you know. I don't read a lot. So I don't know that I've ever read the novel Emma. But all of a sudden, I could see the scenes in relation to Clueless in a way that I hadn't back when Clueless came out. And I was thinking of it in terms of Emma. And it's a new version opening on February 21st.
Thank you very much, Bob Mondello. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Like many people listening to this show, I was made extraordinarily happy by the series finale of The Good Place. I want to call out a specific piece of music that they use near the end of that episode by Estonian-born composer Arvo Pärt, a composer I absolutely love. He does a lot of stuff with he does a lot of choral pieces. He does a lot of this kind of sweeping ambient orchestral music. And this piece in particular is called Spiegel im Spiegel, which translates to Mirror in the Mirror. It was written for piano and violin. There are versions with piano and cello that are so pristine and gorgeous. You can get lost in it. If you listen to the Good Place podcast, Michael Schur talks about the fact that when he was writing the series finale of The Good Place, he holed himself up in like a motel room and listened to this piece of music over and over again on loop from when he woke up in the morning to when he went to bed at night. The entire process of writing that piece was written to this piece of music. I've listened to it so many times that I don't even cry anymore. I'm all out of tears. But it is so beautiful. If you haven't checked it out, the piece is from 1978. Arvo Pärt is still around making gorgeous music. Spiegel im Spiegel by Arvo Pärt.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. What is making me happy this week is a documentary series that has just started on HBO. It's called McMillions, which sometimes they style with a dollar sign on the end, which can make it hard to find, but other times they don't, which is frustrating. It is about the fraud upon the McDonald's Monopoly game throughout the 1990s. And this is not a thing where every now and then somebody was picking up a game piece and you know, it wasn't genuine. This is something where, according to one of the FBI agents in the documentary, there were nearly no big winners who were legitimate throughout the entirety of the 1990s.
Wow.
So they go into kind of the, it sort of begins as a kind of a fun cracking the big heist sort of story. But then they do begin to kind of narrow down and talk about the fact that in every big crime, there are a lot of small crimes, and the small criminals tend to be much sadder stories. So I really appreciated the shape of it. It's a lot of fun to watch. It's also just a great story. It's just a great story, and it takes a lot of unanticipated turns. So I enjoyed it very much. It's called McMillions. I've seen the first three. They're excellent. There are six total, and it has just started on HBO, so you can catch up with that wherever you get your streaming. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Bob at Bob_Mondello. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you're bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here to wrap up the Oscar preview.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. Again, you can find our playlist on Spotify at the Oscars 2020 from Pop Culture Happy Hour. And we will see you all back here Monday morning for the Oscars recap.